from his home in Florida. Saad al-Mahdi, who was imprisoned on a visit to Saudi Arabia. Freedom House, a research and advocacy group, announced that Saudi Arabia has targeted critics in 14 countries. Citing the group, Associated Press reported, the aim is to spy on Saudi citizens and intimidate them or compel them to return to the kingdom. Freedom House's Nate Shenkhan said, of the recent imprisonments of Western-based Saudis, it is disturbing, it's terrifying, and it's a major violation of protected speech. The Saudi kingdom is also charged with ordering the 2018 murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a US-Saudi citizen who used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi royal family. Jamal Khashoggi was dismembered during a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Human rights groups say the Israeli spyware had been installed on the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée. Meanwhile, the British newspaper The Guardian has more on the same story. In the wake of the brutal murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the NSO group denied that its government clients had used its hacking malware to target the journalist or his family. Now, a joint investigation by The Guardian and other media, based on leaked data and forensic analysis of phones, has uncovered new evidence that the Zionist regime's spyware developed by NSO Group, was used to try and monitor people close to Jamal Khashoggi both before and after his death. According to peer-reviewed forensic analysis of her device, in one case, a person in Jamal Khashoggi's inner circle was hacked 4 days after his murder. The investigation points to an apparent attempt by Saudi Arabia and its close ally, the United Arab Emirates, to leverage NSO's spy technology after Khashoggi's death to monitor his associates and the Turkish murder investigation, even going so far as to select the phone of Istanbul's chief prosecutor for potential surveillance. Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered at the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey in October of 2018. While the investigation mostly points to Khashoggi's close associates being targeted in the months after the murder, it also identified evidence suggesting that an NSO client targeted the phone of his former wife, Hanan al-Atr, several months before his death, between November of 2017 and April of 2018. A team of Saudi agents killed Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey, during his visit there to pick up documents he needed to get married to his fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, who later became an outspoken advocate for accountability over his murder. Forensic analysis revealed that Cengiz's phone was first infected with Pegasus just 4 days after his murder on 6th of October 2018. Hatice Cengiz's phone was also hacked on two other days in October of 2018. Data analysis suggests that Saudi Arabia was behind the hacking. The website of the Middle East Monitor has more on the same story. The widow of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was assassinated by Saudi intelligence, sued the notorious Israeli spyware developed by the NSO group. Hanan al-Atr, a 52-year-old, sued Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for their involvement in installing the Israeli company's Pegasus spyware on her mobile phone. Details of the attack on Khashoggi's inner circle were uncovered following a groundbreaking investigation by the Pegasus Project, a collaboration of more than 80 journalists from 17 media organizations in 10 countries. The phone belonging to Khashoggi's former wife, Hanan al-Atr, was on the list of 50,000 leaked members selected for possible surveillance by NSO clients. Hanan al-Atr says, It is important to make everyone involved in this horrible crime accountable. My husband was a peaceful man. Moreover, Hanan added, she is determined to use the US courts of law to get full disclosure about who was potentially spying on her husband and those closest to him in the period before his murder. Once hacked by NSO's software, Pegasus, the targeted phone, can be transformed into a surveillance device that can activate microphones and cameras without the user's knowledge, as well as read all their messages, harvest their address book, monitor their movement, and listen in on their phone calls. The Israeli regime has been under global pressure to stop the export of spyware, Pegasus, since last July, after a group of international rights and media organizations revealed that the Pegasus program produced by NSO was used to hack phones of journalists, prime ministers, officials, and human rights activists all over the world. NSO has also faced lawsuits and criticism from major technology companies, which accuse it of putting their customers at risk of hacking.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities, Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'll be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. Goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system, ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls looked like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And, like, I spent the whole time, like, looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I go back to the block in that condition. And, man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me out of limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is gonna come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks, they had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. Must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MKUltra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating. Physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever. Behind my right ear, or any incision, or any surgery, or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf, and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the president Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. Don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we if there's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know. they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat, you know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blocked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Porcentis pre-tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
China completes first seaborne hot launch with carrier rocket sending 14 satellites to orbit. The Space Dragon 3, also known as the G-Line 3, a commercial carrier rocket, was successfully launched with 14 satellites on board. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Global Times wrote in this regard, China's commercial carrier rockets have welcomed a new member to the family after the Smart Dragon 3 or G-Line 3 made its successful maiden flight recently from the waters of the Yellow Sea, sending 14 satellites precisely into their designated orbit. Its debut further expanded the spectrum of China's launch vehicles and marked the country's first hot seaborne launch, filling multiple technical gaps in China's domestic aerospace industry. The vehicle, developed and manufactured by the state-owned China Academy of Launch Vehicle Technology, CALT, is a four-stage solid propellant carrier rocket with a total length of about 31 meters and a diameter of up to 2.65 meters. It weighs about 140 tons. Smart Dragon 3 is capable of sending a 1.5-ton payload to the 500-kilometer sun, synchronous orbits has a larger nose cone with a diameter of 3.35 meters that provides more space for payloads and diversified launch modes and is more cost-efficient, the Global Times recently wrote. Based in China, Dongfang spacecraft launch port in Heyang is China's Shandong province. Developers integrated the manufacture, assembly, and launch of the Smart Dragon 3, significantly shortening the launch process and improving efficiency. CALT added that it is a highly reliable launch vehicle fitted with facilities that support both land and sea-based launches to meet future demand for rapid satellite constellations and is capable of completing technical preparations and satellite launch within just 1 week. The rollout of the vehicle will reduce payload cost to $10,000 per kilogram, said Jiang Ji, a CALT rocket expert and academician of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, highlighting the model's strong market competitiveness. Seaborne launches in China have historically been cold launches, which use a booster powered by compressed air, steam, or gas to launch the vehicle to a certain altitude before starting the rocket engine, experts said. This time, Smart Dragon 3 propelled itself out of the launching cell using its own engine, which eliminates the need for a separate system to eject the vehicle from launching the tube. Cold launches will have little impact on the ship's hull as vehicles are ignited in the air. However, this mode is more complicated and the launching tube is customized for only one type of rocket. Hull launches, however, have simpler launching cells and are capable of rapid launches, so they can realize multiple launches in one trip. Wang Yan, chief editor of Beijing-based Aerospace Knowledge magazine, told the Global Times. While the extreme heat during hot launches will cause some damage to equipment on board the ship, China has developed the ability to minimize this impact, for example, through temperature-resistant treatment for the ship or by diverting the gas produced during the rocket ignition to the side and then emitting it outside, Wang explained. Moving forward, CALT is planning to send an even larger solid propellant carrier rocket. The Smart Dragon 4, with a payload capacity of 2.5 tons to the sun synchronous orbit. Seaborne launches will be further upgraded as more professional vessels for rocket launches are being constructed at China Dongfang spacecraft launch port with the aim of realizing multiple launches in a single trip. Researchers are also studying the feasibility of building a fixed launching platform on the sea, further lowering the requirements for sea-based launches and increasing cost efficiency and flexibility. Among the 14 satellites sent into orbit during the recent mission was Torch-1, China's first space life science experimental satellite for commercial spaceflight. It was developed by private firm Rocket P and will carry out observations on microbial growth in microgravity conditions in the food industry, the Global Times learned from the company. Also, Yahoo News wrote in this regard, China has successfully completed its first seaborne hot launch of a carrier rocket from the Yellow Sea on December 9th. The Space Dragon 3, also known as the G-Line 3, a commercial carrier rocket, was successfully launched with 14 satellites on board at 2:35 p.m. local time on Friday, December 9th. The China Aerospace Science and Technology Corporation has said. China has previously completed cold launches at sea where a missile is expelled from a launch tube using gas produced externally. The launch of Space Dragon 3 marks the country's first hot launch at sea, where the rocket launches itself using onboard fuel, local media reported.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our master, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remaining vestige of God on earth. I'm very happy and thankful to God that after a relatively long break, I have the honor to see you young graduates again in a face-to-face meeting on this day this year. It is good to hear that several thousand young people have joined the armed forces, and this happens every year, whether it is young university graduates who have earned the rank of officer and enter the workforce, and those who enter the university receive a shoulder mark and a study. Both of them inject a new spirit into the armed forces in a certain way. Both of these groups of young people being a message of renewal and stability.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Whenever young people enter a place, whenever they join an association or an organization, they actually bring the message of strength and renewal to that place. The presence of the Iranian youth in all fields is promising. So whenever they enter various fields, such as the scientific, economic, political, organizational, and military sectors, they bring with them the positive message of hope, renewal, and innovation. Today, there is a misleading propaganda campaign going on that tries to show the opposite of this. The aim of this propaganda is to imply that the Iranian youth have lost their values, have no hope for the future, and do not feel they have any sort of responsibility. there is a propaganda campaign that is seriously pursuing this goal. But the reality of this matter is the opposite of this. What is happening in our country is the exact opposite. Our younger generation has progressed brilliantly in all fields and arenas up until today.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
In Britain, police chiefs have refused a request from the ambulance service for support during the strikes amid rising anger over pay. Police chiefs are saying that officers are unlikely to stand in for striking ambulance drivers. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. Police say they will not replace striking ambulance drivers as health trusts scramble to limit the effects of a wave of industrial action. The health trusts, which are responsible for running ambulances, have approached individual police forces to see if officers might ferry patients to and from hospital. Police chiefs, however, say their forces are too busy and that relatively few police drivers have the necessary C1 license needed to drive an ambulance. Health services are bracing for strikes later this month. Ultimately, the decision will be up to each of the 43 local police forces across England and Wales, which are operationally independent, as is the National British Transport Police and the Civil Nuclear Constabulary. The National Police Chiefs Council, representing law enforcement's leadership, said on Friday 9th of December that requests to drive ambulances were highly likely to be rebuffed. Assistant Chief Constable Owen Wetherill, the National Mobilisation Coordinator, said, "Policing must ensure it can deliver its own core business. Police officers already deal with issues that arise from ambulance attendance times, often related to mental health incidents. For police officers to drive an ambulance, they need to have a specific driving qualification, which many within policing do not hold. If police officers do hold this, it means that they have a qualification to drive police vehicles needed for dealing with public order incidents and are needed by forces. Preservation of life will always be policing's number one priority, and that has not changed. Policing is often seen as the service of last resort, but police chiefs must make decisions balancing ever-growing demands. The demands on policing are significant, and it is vital that we deliver our own priorities to protect the public and to catch criminals first. Police vehicles tend to be lighter than ambulances and thus require a different driving license. One source estimated that only a few hundred police officers across England and Wales were licensed to drive an ambulance. The Metropolitan Police loaned officers to the London Ambulance Service during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020, but that was at a time when the demands of policing were lower because of the lockdown. British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story and gives us more detail. Police chiefs have refused a request from the ambulance service for support during strikes amid rising anger over pay, The Telegraph can reveal. Ambulance bosses are understood to have approached forces about using officers to drive vehicles during the forthcoming industrial action. But police chiefs have rejected the request, insisting they do not have the resources available to step in and help the National Health Service. In a statement, the National Police Chiefs Council said the demands on policing remain significant and it was vital officers focused on their own priorities of protecting the public and catching criminals. However, the Telegraph understands there is also simmering anger within policing over public sector strikes, with police officers fearful industrial action elsewhere will increase their workload. Many police officers are also furious that their pay settlement is less than what is being offered to workers who are allowed to strike. Ambulance staff across most of England and Wales are due to walk out on 21st of December in a dispute over pay. The coordinated walkout by the three main ambulance unions, Unison, GMB and Unite, will affect non-life-threatening calls only, but could mean people who have falls are not responded to. Military personnel are being trained to drive ambulances when necessary, but defence sources have expressed unease that soldiers are being forced to give up their Christmas to cover for striking paramedics. One senior policing source told The Telegraph, "Just as the army is pushing back and are saying we can't strike and we're having to cancel Christmas to cover for all these public service strikes, well, the same is happening to the police force. Not only are we restricted from striking, quite rightly, because the security of the state with the army is the most important thing in terms of civil society, but we're supposed to be recognised for that. All the police can see is that people who can strike get more money, and who fills in for them when they strike? The police, of course. It is understood the request was made locally to some police forces by regional ambulance trusts as part of a contingency planning." Assistant Chief Constable Owen Wetherill from the National Police Chiefs Council said, "Policing must ensure it can deliver its own core business. Police officers already deal with issues from existing ambulance attendance times, often related to mental health incidents. For police officers to drive an ambulance, they need to have a specific driving qualification, which many within policing do not hold. If police officers do hold this, it means that they also have the qualification to drive police vehicles needed for dealing with public order incidents and are needed by police forces. Preservation of life will always be policing's number one priority, and that has not changed. Policing is often seen as the service of last resort, but police chiefs must make decisions balancing ever-growing demands. The demands on policing are significant, and it is vital that we deliver our own priorities to protect the public and catch criminals first."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The 18th International Muslim Forum has summed up celebrations of the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the Volga, Bulgaria. Many religious figures addressed the International Forum. Russian Mufti Sheikh Ravil Gaynuddin called for a just world order from the standpoint of the East. Chairman of the Turkish Department of Religious Affairs, Ali Erbaş, spoke about the connection between justice and security. Chief Justice of Palestine, Mahmoud Al-Habash, accused Israel and the United States of violating international law. The main two words, justice and a new world order, became the leitmotif of the plenary session.
We have gathered here to raise the voice of justice and moderation, to exchange scientific opinions through dialogue. The Islamic State, the Muslims of Russia, all of us must stand together against the liberalism that they are trying to impose on us. This false world view is in fact engaged in the seizure of the world's material wealth and assets. Our joint cooperation should be directed against this upstart arrogance, despotism, and oppression of the liberal world. The Islamic principles of the worldview are the values that the world could take as an example.
Back in 1881, the Russian Muslim thinker and educator Ismail B. Gasprinsky wrote that in the near future, quote, Russia will be destined to become one of the significant Muslim states, which will not in the least diminish its significance as a great Christian power. The participants of the forum are convinced that his dream is coming true today. Russian Muslims, hand in hand with their partners, are making a unique contribution to renewing the global discourse on justice. The rapprochement of the Islamic world with Russia and success in this matter is directly related to the openness of the Russian civilization to its Eastern heritage, including the spiritual tradition of Russian Muslims.
We are being imposed a globalist, neoliberal understanding of the modern world order. The imposition is very aggressive. They encroached on a family. Many have caved into these patterns of the new world order. The Islamic world, which reads the Quran and is charged with energy and the word of the Quran, is trying to resist and adjoin those centers that are able to challenge and protect humanity from destructive energy. Russia is the defender of the classical traditional order set forth in the sacred scriptures. Therefore, one must follow this path, not lose hope, not give up, because this is a Quranic instruction to unite and be a single organism, a single ummah.
The participants of the forum believe that the time has come to talk about a just world order not only from the standpoint of the West, but also from the East.
Russia is celebrating the 1,100th anniversary of the adoption of Islam by the people of Volga, Bulgaria, marking the importance of Islam in the country. This year is commemorated with the participation of representatives from dozens of Muslim countries during various events. The anniversary is also an opportunity for Russia to strengthen its ties with participating Muslim countries that have been isolated by the West. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Kubashevsky District, Donetsk. A child is wounded by Ukrainian shelling. An ambulance took her to the hospital, but a second didn't arrive fast enough, so a local volunteer, Andrei, puts the child's mother in the back of his van and drives her there himself. Ukraine has a history of shelling civilians in Donetsk since 2014. Over recent days, they've increased the slaughter. More than a dozen have been killed in the last 4 days. Nowhere in the city is safe. Two supermarkets were hit in the space of 2 days.
The city has been hit hard today, multiple strikes around the center. The death toll is already up to 5. We're racing around the city to check out the damage.
We pass a market. It caught on fire due to a strike. Flowers are placed outside for a woman killed at the same spot a few weeks ago. We arrive at the site of another strike. There's a body on the ground and two more inside.
Now, while many of the attacks by Ukraine in Donetsk are aimed at civil infrastructure or administration buildings, some are simple terror attacks against civilians. The building here is a youth center. The woman who was killed